Good afternoon. Welcome to the Transportation Policy and Finance Committee. I'll call this meeting to order. And first order of business, Representative Runbeck, have you had a chance to review the minutes of Monday, March 21st?
Mr. Chair, I move the minutes of March 21st.
Thank you. Representative Runbeck moves the minutes of March 21st. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Minutes are approved. Members, we're going to change order around a little bit. We do have some people who are traveling south into the heart of the winter storm here. So we're going to go with House File 1112, Representative Norton first. Representative Norton, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1112, and I have there are two amendments in your packet. The first amendment is 1112A1. They're both, I think we'll consider them both author's amendments.
Okay.
The first one is as a result, Mr. Chair, of committee meetings that I've had for the last 2 years with multiple departments and advocates, and these, after the last meeting we had, these were changes suggested in those meetings, and I think it doesn't subsequently change the bill, but does improve it, actually. So if we could move the
okay.
A1.
So Representative Norton moves the 1112A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. That motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, the A3 is a technical amendment that our wonderful staff did some thinking about this and decided that we needed to make it perfect. And so this is a technical amendment from our staff, and I would move the A3.
Great. Representative Norton moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Amendment is also approved. So Representative Norton, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I'm very appreciative for the bill hearing today. This is a very important issue to me, my constituents, the citizens of the state, and I hope to you as well. My first encounter with the whole topic of ignition interlock was when I first ran for office 12 years ago. I was out door knocking, and I met a woman who begged me, if I got elected, to take up the ignition interlock issue. And I had no idea what ignition interlock was. And so I stood on her doorstep for quite some time as she explained to me that she had a son who was alcoholic, who had multiple DUI arrests, who had his license revoked, and who was continuing to drive. And she was terrified for him, and she was terrified for the people in our community that he might injure. So that was my very first introduction to this important topic. I came here, I was able to serve on a conference committee for the initial ignition interlock bill we passed a number of years ago, and it's had some modifications since. My attempt today in this bill is to really take a serious, hard position on ignition interlock and have it be applicable after first offense. And so I'm going to give you just a few pieces of data and detail about, you know, why I believe this, and then some constituents from Rochester have joined me today, and they would like to tell you their story, and hopefully you'll give them some time. And then if you have questions and you want me to go through the specifics of the bill, I will do so, but just I think the overall overview of the bill is that it makes it to a mandatory ignition interlock after first offense. It does reduce the fine so that the folks that are being asked to be on ignition interlock, rather than pay the court's money that goes into a special fund, it can actually go to pay for the ignition interlock device that we would require them to have. So it was kind of a compromise on that. And again, I can walk you through some of the other parts of the bill, but it also streamlines the process as well. And as I said, we worked with multiple departments on this. So if I could just quick read some facts and data for you, is that?
Absolutely, Representative. I just want to let the committee members know that this will be moving on to public safety, where they also have an opportunity to hear this bill. So that this is the path.
So. Yeah. So members, 25,258 people in Minnesota were arrested for DUI in the last reported year. 80% on average of drinking drivers arrested have had one or no prior DUIs, but likely have driven 80 to 90 times before their arrest. In 2012, more than 10,000 people died in alcohol-impaired driving crashes in the United States, which is one in every 51 minutes. In Minnesota, 31% or 111 of the traffic deaths had alcohol involvement. 2,040 people suffered injuries from alcohol-related incidents. And this information is from U.S. Department of Transportation and the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. Right now, 25 states require ignition interlock for all offenders. Minnesota does not. We have a modified statute. And I would encourage you to look at the color handout that we had printed in here. This was from the National Council of State Legislatures and kind of remarkably was published of March of this year. And it's quite comprehensive and has some really good information in it. So I'd refer you to that. Currently, Minnesota requires a 0.16 blood alcohol content for first-time offenders to get ignition interlock. The average blood alcohol concentrate for drivers with a DWI was 1.5, with the average blood alcohol content for drunk driver involved in a fatal crash being 0.19. So what we're finding is that, on average, our Minnesota law is failing to capture the majority of DWI first-time offenders, and through ignition interlock, when they are caught, we can keep them from the repeat offenders, which I'll talk about in just a moment, is a serious issue. I just want to talk about the 0.15 for just a second. If you look into the research, many states use 0.15 rather than 0.16, which is what Minnesota does, and 0.15 is considered heavy legal drinking, and we use the 0.16, and so it does mean that we are not putting folks on ignition interlock until well after, you know, they're considered legally or heavily drunk. And just to put that in perspective, it takes a 160-pound male 4 drinks per hour to be at the 0.08. So when people are being caught with the 0.15 or 0.16, that's a lot of alcohol they've consumed in a very short period of time. And I think sometimes we don't realize that. We think it's just a drink or two, and it is not. It's important to note that the high percentage of drivers whose licenses are revoked or canceled continue to drive, and that alone is the best argument that ignition interlock should be mandatory. In fact, up to 75% of DWI offenders continue to drive illegally without a license, 40,000 Minnesotans currently. Ignition interlock is a surefire way to keep DUI drivers off the roads. Suspensions don't keep people from driving and from driving drunk. Ignition interlock allows people to regain their driving privileges or retain their driving privileges, which is very important for families where the person that has been caught driving is employed, working, raising a family. The ignition interlock allows them to continue their functions, to keep their job, but to still suffer the consequences. But those consequences... enforcement actually helps all of us. The consequence for them is that they have the ignition interlock in their car, and there may be some discomfort with that, but the protection that it provides all of us on the road with them is significant. One of the things that I just saw on Twitter recently was St. Patrick's Day. The Department of Public Safety, if you don't follow them on Twitter, they have a really nice tweet effort going on, and I retweet quite often. On St. Patrick's Day, they stopped 462 drivers in Ramsey County, so it's just one tiny county, and of those, 55 of them were driving on a revoked or canceled license. I mean, just think of that. One county, one night, one time, people, when their licenses are taken from them, they just try to wait out their sentence. They drive without a license. They're uninsured, and they put all of us at risk. Ignition interlock effectively reduces repeat drunk driving rates by 67%. And in some states, like Arizona, for instance, they've reduced drunk driving deaths by up to 50% after implementing an ignition interlock after first offense. It has widespread support, 76 to 88% in the various polls that have been done recently, and there's widespread support in groups, certainly insurance companies, CDC, National Transportation Safety Board, and others. So I'm here today because of the risk drunk drivers are to us all and our loved ones. I would like to ask Sandy and Hillary Melville from Rochester to come up. They've been fearless advocates for first offense mandatory ignition interlock, and I would very much like for you to hear their story. And so, Mr. Chair, if Sandy and Hillary would come up.
Certainly. Good afternoon and welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the committee record.
My name is Sandy Melville.
My name is Hillary Melville.
Welcome. Please continue.
Thank you. I wanted to thank you in advance for this opportunity. It's an honor. It's an honor to be asked to come here. I can't share enough of my heartfelt thank you with Representative Norton for allowing me to be a relentless pain in the butt for her, to her for the last 4 years. This is the passion and the mission of my life for my son. And I said to my husband when we heard the weather forecast, come hell or high water, and I didn't say snow, we're going up there. I've tried to condense my talk. I'll slow down a little bit. Try to imagine not having a chance to see your kids succeed in life. To get that job after graduating from college with honors, to watch them marry, to see them become parents, and to miss out on every single adult milestone and momentous occasion that life brings. Imagine getting that call in the middle of the night to find out your son was killed. Imagine hearing that he was hit and killed on impact, one step from the curb, by a drunk driver speeding down the city street. Imagine hearing that your son was hit so hard by this previous offender that he was thrown 51 feet onto the sidewalk. Imagine hoping your son's death was so swift that he didn't suffer or feel the horrendous pain of his life-ending injuries. Imagine calling his fiance to tell her that he was killed by a drunk driver. Imagine having a funeral director ask you what your son's 23-year-old son's wishes were. There's absolutely no way you'll ever imagine this horror unless it happens to your family. Nothing in life prepares you for the loss of one of your kids. It's not supposed to happen. No amount of time heals the loss of one of your kids. Parents are not supposed to outlive their kids. My son Austin never caused me a gray hair. He was an absolute walk in the park. He was brilliant. He was interesting, talented, fun, and an absolute joy to have and to be with. He had such a promising life ahead of him that he worked very hard to achieve. Our life has changed forever, and we lost our only son, and he lost everything. There is no normal. Austin would be mad as hell to know what was taken from him, and he would expect us to do something and not just to sit on our hands. So for my son, this is all I can do. We've talked to over 20 groups of offenders at victim impact panels throughout southern Minnesota. The panels in Mankato are held monthly and are attended by 100 to 200 offenders. When we're in Mankato, we're joined by an exceptional state trooper, Trooper Gabe Cornish. Gabe shares with the offenders the results of a controlled alcohol study done on volunteers by the state patrol, which appears surprising to the offenders hearing the details. After drinking 7 to 8 drinks, the volunteers, with their judgment impaired, thought they were okay to drive. Applying ignition interlocks for all offenders will not only deter many from excessive drinking and driving, but it will also change the social attitude that this is okay to do. As an example, a coworker of mine was talking about his softball team. And he said to me that the losing team has to drink up all the beer. And he says, we just take the back roads home. This exemplifies the attitude of the general drinking public that it's okay to drink and drive as long as you don't get caught. And if they do, they think it's nothing more than a mistake. I can tell you the only things that keep my feet on the ground are trying to be there for my daughter and trying to make a difference for my son. We can't reach everyone. We need your help and we need your action. You have the power and the authority to enact life-saving ignition interlock for all offenders making the deadly choice to drink and drive. Saving lives, sending a message of deterrence, and showing you care for the safety of all Minnesotans could not be more simple than enacting ignition interlocks for all people that make that deadly choice. The life you save with this legislation may be the life of someone you love. No one knows if the headlights coming at them in the dark are that of an alcohol-impaired driver. No more innocent people should be killed or families shattered because of a drunk driver's deadly choice to drink and drive. Thank you so much for your time.
Judgment. It's one of the first things to go when a person is drinking. They lose the capability of making good decisions and do things that they would not do if they were sober. Sandy mentioned that Gabe Cornish tells of a test that the State Patrol did regarding when people will decide they should not be driving. After they drink too much, they cannot make that decision appropriately. And that probably explains the high recidivism rate for DUI. I believe that most persons going through the trauma of a DUI do not want to go through it a second time, recognizing that things will be even worse with a multiple offense. Why then is recidivism rate at about 40%? Because persons who had no intention of driving drunk again are unable to make the appropriate decision once they have imbibed too much. A sober person still makes their own decision on when and where to drive in a car with an interlock. But a person who has been drinking, who may lack the judgment to decide appropriately, is stopped. And the one-year period that the interlock is installed provides an opportunity to learn how to adjust one's lifestyle to remove a reliance on driving after drinking. With the limited implementation that is currently in place, there have been over 58,000 episodes of an ignition interlock preventing someone with an BAC of 0.08 or greater from driving in Minnesota. The program works, and expanding it will make the road safer for all of us. MAD statistics show that the states which have passed all offender ignition interlock laws have experienced significant reductions in drunk driving fatalities. 25 states have now passed all offender ignition interlock laws. Minnesota should be joining that list. This may not be a law that your constituents will be patting you on the back for. It is prophylactic. No one can know whose life has been saved by the drunk driving that was prevented. We don't have an It's a Wonderful Life capability of seeing what would have happened if that impaired driver would have been able to get behind the wheel. So we can't celebrate the fact of a crash that never happened. Push this bill forward and go home and hug your spouse and kids, because the life you saved may have been one of theirs. On the other hand, you could let the bill die. You could leave the ignition interlock as a tool to be used only after a second offense. And at some point, you'll read about a person, maybe one of your constituents, who was killed by a drunk driver. The newspaper will just say that the driver had a previous DUI. It won't make any point about the crash might have been prevented if an ignition interlock program for all offenders had been implemented. But you will know. And you will get that sudden tightness in the chest as you realize that this one is on you. The pain will dissipate shortly. But for the family of the one who was killed, it will never go away. Please do the right thing by making ignition interlocks mandatory for all DUI offenders in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Is questions if anyone would like it.
Are there any questions from members?
And I will just say Sandy does speak regularly about this issue, so I think if you do have questions, I don't think you need to be afraid to ask them.
I do.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for sharing your loss and your thoughts with us. I support the bill, so don't take offense at the questions I'm going to ask. I just literally don't know. But the two questions that popped to mind for me, one is the, in the course of the bill, is the cost associated with the device affordable enough that the offender will take advantage of it rather than, for example, borrowing a different car? You think about how folks get around these sorts of things. And you've alluded, Representative Morton, to the cost. I don't know how much it costs. Is that...
Representative Morton?
Well, I can start this, and if they have anything to add, they can. It is one of the reasons that we did lower the... We took the $430 current reinstatement charge out, but left the $250 fine at the beginning in, because we do understand that for some people it is a matter of cost. There is a fund for people that are indigent that need it, so that has already established, as I understand it, and can be used. So cost is certainly a factor. The good news is that as the technology has improved, and for those of you that might have heard how hard ignition interlock was when it first started, I have a family member who has used it, so I can tell you at the very beginning, when they first started, they weren't great, and they are much better now, and the costs have actually come down. So I'm going to say roughly $100 a month. So we're going to be taking off $430 of the fine, so that will not be just given to that special fund in the courts, but can be used for ignition interlock. For some people, it may be a deterrent, but when you have the option of keeping your car and your license and your insurance and having the revocation, I think most of the states are finding a better uptake. When it's mandatory for first offense, more are taking up on it. We do have some now who aren't and who are just waiting it out, and it is a concern. And I'm sure for some, the funding is a part of it, and the department will have to do a little better job, I think, as we move ahead to make sure that that finances aren't the thing stopping the person from going in.
Yeah. And that,
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. That's helpful. If you had asked me to guess, I would have said a couple $1,000. And I think that's just because that was a figure that stuck in my head from some time ago. But, if it's a device that allows people to keep driving that car, it allows them to get to and from work, so they've got income. And I've always heard, though, that what they do to end around it is they drive a different car. Speaking of end arounding, it is the device, if you just have somebody else sit in your passenger seat and blow into the device, is that another way? I'm not trying to give anybody advice on how to avoid this. I just wonder if it's sensitive to the individual or...
I don't, Mr. Chair. I don't believe yet it's not like a fingerprint recognition that I'm aware of. I haven't heard about that technology, but they do have cameras in them now, and it's mandated by law that there's a camera, so you can actually check to see that it's the person that said it is. And again, the car will only start if you don't have alcohol in your system and on your breath. And then once you get going, there's a rolling check to make certain that somewhere between 7 and 15 minutes, and it may be a little different with the different devices, you do a check once you're driving. If it comes back that you somehow cheated the system at the beginning, but now you're driving and you blow back in there and it checks alcohol on you, the car does not stop, because that's been an issue for some people. Are you going to put people's life at risk if the car just stops and they're on a highway? It doesn't do that. It gives you some time to pull over. And if you don't and you flag that you have alcohol, either your lights will start flashing or a horn will go off. So you will either be embarrassed driving down the street and being obnoxiously noisy. And then the other thing that can happen, and this is for, I think, further discussion and debate, the company that it would register that someone is driving with alcohol in their breath, they could actually, if you have a high, if you're blowing in there and you're drunk, they could send the police out.
And we do have an individual from an interlock company is going to testify today as well.
Far more accurate than my generalizations.
My apologies. I didn't realize. I thought this might be the end of the
testimony, Mr. Chairman. No problem, Representative Atkins.
So that was, and you alluded to the, perhaps it's for the interlock, but it's a zero tolerance. So if you have, if you're at 0.01 or 0.02 or 0.03.
I had heard at one point it was 0.02, is it 0.02? Am I saying that right?
And maybe I'll just
but
leave that one out there for
The really experts would be better at that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Norton. And thank you very much to the parents.
Any other questions from members? Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I thank the author for bringing this forward. I've got some personal experiences I'd like to share, but I do see one flaw in the bill, and the interlock mandating the interlock use is contingent on a conviction. In October of 2008, my wife and I were hit by a drunk driver, and he was processed with law enforcement in St. Louis County, and we were hospitalized and had ongoing therapy to recover from that. We were lucky. A month later, before this individual could be prosecuted, he got another DUI. A month later, before he was prosecuted for the first two, he got another DUI. Is there a way we could alter this piece of legislation to say if he was deemed intoxicated, we could do this immediately rather than wait for the judicial system to catch up? Because this guy was operating, obviously, for months at a time, just freewheeling, drinking, carrying on. So that's the only flaw in your bill that I see, is it doesn't kick in quick enough.
And we do have thank you, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. We do have a component of the bill in the criminal part that the courts could, as a condition of release, require ignition interlock. It would be up to the judge and the courts, but that part is in there. If it goes through on the criminal side. Do I have that? Am I saying that correctly? Okay. Mr. Chair, could we have?
Absolutely.
Mr. Chair, Rebecca Purius from House Research.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, actually, upon arrest, the license is revoked or canceled, and at that point, it can be the person would have to go on ignition interlock. So it does already occur before conviction. There is a 7-day wait period between the time of arrest and the time of the revocation, but it does occur at arrest currently.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. and Ms. Melville, for your testimony today. I believe we have Mr. Froelich from Intoxilock. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the committee record.
My name is Brad Froelich. I'm with a company called Intoxilock by Consumer Safety Technology. I'm here representing our company, and we are a member of the Coalition of Ignition Interlock Manufacturers, which includes five of the largest providers of ignition interlocks in the country, including three of the five providers here in the state of Minnesota. We are here just to say that we support this bill. Not only does it add an all-offender component, but we think it really streamlines your DWI statute. As a state government relations director, I see all 50 states, and you guys have one of the more convoluted DWI statutes, and I think this is an important step forward to make it simpler, to make it better. We wholeheartedly support it. And it sounds like, in the interest of brevity, there's a lot of questions, so I will end my testimony there just to say that we support it, and if there are any questions, leave some time for that.
Thank you. Members, questions for the testifier? Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your testimony. Is it, in fact, is it a 0.02? I saw that some nodding, but I don't know if that was...
0.02. Yes, that is correct. That is the standard in the state of Minnesota. That is the most common standard across the country.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions from members? Representative Norton, you had a
Well, I just thought I'd, as long as we have the Ignition Interlock folks up here, I would just, Matt has a handout that, because people might wonder, is there a place near me? That would seem to be a question folks might want to know. And it says there are five manufacturers that provide devices at over 190 state certified installation centers. And as of September 2014, there were 7,864 interlocks installed in Minnesota, and that has gone up now in the last year. So there are 190, at least as of September 14, and I assume there are more now, places that you can get your Ignition Interlock and have it tested, or what do they call that when they have to test it?
Monitor.
Yeah, and make sure it's functional.
Okay. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for the testifier. I can't remember his name.
Mr. Frelick.
Mr. Frelick.
Mr. Frelick. Thank you, Mr. Frelick. So can you outline for us, I know there are some drawbacks to some of the ignition interlock. The science isn't foolproof. I've got constituents who have had some experience with this. I've been in touch with a number of them and also talk to law enforcement about some of this as well. There are situations where cough medicine and other things can trigger this. What are other everyday items that can trigger the ignition interlock?
Well, the devices that are used in Minnesota are fuel cell devices. That means they will trigger on alcohol, as you stated, mouthwash and cough syrups and those things. If a substance is introduced into the device that contains alcohol, it will trigger. It is designed to detect alcohol. However, in both the user manual and in all of the documentation that they get, and including at when they are installed, they are told that, this will detect those sources. So what they are told is that if you must take like a cough syrup or thing, either you wait a specific period of time, because what you're talking about in mouthwash or cough syrup mostly is going to be residual mouth alcohol. So you don't want to go out there to the device and take it, within 10 minutes or so, because you still could get a residual reading. In the case of cough syrup, since you're consuming that, it's not going to come back out at a level that would prevent you from operating your car. For most people, a standard dose of cough medicine is the equivalent of about half of a drink. So you would be hard-pressed to be so small to even have that even register on the device. So that would not do that. As far as some of the other limitations, in some of the other states, there is a concern that, well, they can just install the device on one car and then they can just drive another. Minnesota, the department here has the forethought in looking at that, and they said, okay, we're not only going to require the use, but we're going to require a mandatory minimum number of start attempts during that monitoring report period. So if they're just sitting in the driveway, the department's going to catch them. And it does, the device does have a camera. With some of the providers, it's mounted near where the mirror is, more toward the front. In the case of ours, it's over on the passenger side. It takes a picture, including the whole front part of the cabin, so it can tell if someone is trying to get someone else to test and all that. And all of that information is downloaded and sent to the department at the monitoring appointment. So the department has all this information.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Frolick. So I've got a constituent who measured, I don't remember what the absolute numbers were, but they were in excess of whatever that number was. They claim that they hadn't had anything to drink. And obviously a lot of people claim they haven't had anything to drink at that point. But in this situation, as soon as it was triggered, he called a police officer in the nearest town, and within 5 minutes later, met the police officer in the town, and the police officer used his equipment for them to blow into, and he came out at zero.
Yeah.
So can you explain what happened there?
Sure. That would,
Mr. Frelick.
That's absolutely, that would be some form of residual mouth alcohol, whether it is a mouthwash or, unfortunately, a lot of these breath mints and the sprays and things like that contain alcohol. But what you said is exactly correct. What we tell the people is if you know, if they don't do what you describe, is wait 10 minutes or go back in the house, rinse your mouth out, go back out. We're not talking about alcohol that's coming out of the bloodstreams. We're talking about residual mouth alcohol. Ethyl alcohol is a highly volatile substance, which means it evaporates very quickly. You could, you know, go out to your car, swig some old brown Listerine, which is almost 70%, blow a 0.50, and if you sat there and waited 15 minutes and you tested again, you would be clear. So what you're describing is clearly a case of some sort of residual mouth alcohol. We don't know the source, but there was something there that the device was triggering.
Representative Norton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Oskowski, I think that's one of the things as states are using this and it's becoming more and more common, that education piece is really important. And as I mentioned, I've had a family member who has used this as well as ignition interlock and had some trouble with that. The other thing I will say, though, for some people, and it probably is not the case here, is that sometimes people will drink very heavily in the evening, will sleep someplace because they know they shouldn't be driving or their car won't start, and then they get up in the morning and they think they can drive, and in fact they still have enough alcohol in their bloodstream that even in the morning when they're trying to go to work, the car won't start. But that is a different situation than was described, and the instructions say rinse, if something like that happens, rinse your mouth off with water. And in fact, if it were me and I was on ignition interlock, I think I would start using mouthwashes that were non-alcohol, of which there are plenty, and you know, I'd be careful about that. But there is an education component to this for someone that goes on ignition interlock that I think we just have to acknowledge.
Well, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Chair and Representative Norton and others, I supported the initial ignition interlock bill and helped swiftly in its passage. I remember the discussion, but there are some kinks in this system, and in this case with this individual, we're still in the process of talking to the department. But had he not had the wherewithal to call the police, and actually the police officer documented the time of his call and the time of him checking in town, etc., had he not done that, the government doesn't believe him at that point. They believe what the ignition interlock said, and that's all that government has to go with at that point. And I think we need to perfect the system we have before we push it too much harder. We've got a lot of work to do to make it even better, and I like the idea behind it, but I've gotten enough of these calls that there's some work we have to do. I don't know exactly how to say it any differently than that.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify in favor or in opposition of this bill? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the committee record, and we do just have a few moments.
Thank you. Gina Calistra. I'll talk as fast as I can. Good afternoon. It's an honor to be here today to talk to you about MADS support for a proven safety strategy that can help eliminate the completely preventable violent crime of drunk driving. I want to recognize Representative Norton for her efforts to author this life-saving legislation to improve Minnesota's drunk driving law. We hear a lot about the tragic consequences of drunk driving, the empty seat at the dinner table during the holidays, the hole in the daughter's heart that will never be filled. April 12, 2009, Easter Sunday, the day that forever changed my life, the day my parents were struck by a drunk driver. When our holiday celebration came to an end, my mother hugged me and said, as she and my father got in their vehicle, "Gina, this was the best Easter ever." Little did I know, 5 minutes later, our lives would be changed forever. My parents were struck head-on by a drunk driver traveling at 60 miles per hour southbound in a northbound lane. My sister and her young children came upon the crash as they were following not far behind. My parents were both critically injured. My father was transported by ambulance, my mother by helicopter. They never saw each other conscious again. 63 days later, my father, a Vietnam veteran who served on the Minneapolis Police Department for 30 years, succumbed to his injuries. My mother faced years of therapy around her injuries, but more painful was the heartbreak of losing my father. The drunk driver who hit my parents was a repeat DWI offender who was required and should have been on ignition interlock, chose to opt out, wait, and obviously continue to drive. He was unharmed physically, but must now live forever with the fact that his bad decision to drink and drive took the life of a one-of-a-kind, larger-than-life man who meant the world to so many. As a volunteer with MAD Minnesota, I stand here today to talk about a solution to stop drunk driving and what lawmakers and community partners in Minnesota can do to create a state and a nation of no more victims. MAD calls on the Minnesota House to pass a law to require ignition locks for all drunk drivers. These handheld devices, as we've heard today, prevent a car from starting if the driver's been drinking. We know nationally these devices have prevented attempts to drive drunk more than 1.7 million times since the states implemented their current ignition interlock laws. Through a survey of interlock providers mentioned earlier operating in Minnesota, we know that since July of 2011, ignition locks have stopped 58,350 attempts by previously convicted drunk drivers to once again drive drunk in Minnesota. Let me say this again. Intoxicated, previously convicted DUI offenders with an illegal blood alcohol concentration of 0.08 or greater over the legal limit in Minnesota have attempted to drive drunk another 58,000 times in less than 5 years. In 2011, lawmakers enacted legislation requiring interlocks for all repeat offenders and first-time offenders with a blood alcohol concentration of 0.16 or greater. Without this legislative action, 58,000 additional attempts to drive drunk would not have been prevented. MAD Minnesota applauds that leadership. Now let's think about how many drunk drivers we're missing. How many are out there today driving drunk? Because we are not requiring them for every offender after the first offense. Tragically, we only hear about them after they've torn yet another family apart. We all deserve better. In Minnesota and across the nation, residents and visitors deserve to drive without the fear that the driver next to them has recklessly chosen to drink and drive. This cannot be achieved by simply taking a license away. MAD knows that 50 to 75% of drunk driving offenders continue to drive on a revoked license, like the gentleman that struck my parents. And because research has proven that ignition interlocks are effective in reducing recidivism, we believe interlocks should be a component of any other alcohol program that follows a drunk driving offense. We can no longer take away driving privileges and simply hope for the best. As research shows, our best defense against the dangerous decision to drink and drive is a technology that takes the decision out of the hands of the would-be drunk driver. 25 other states have ignition interlock laws for all drunk driving offenders, and two more states, Maryland and Pennsylvania, are very close to passing new all-offender laws this year. Minnesota is one of 14 states that only require ignition interlocks for repeat offenders and first-time offenders with a BAC of 1.16 or greater. Today, MAD calls on Minnesota House to take action on all-offender ignition interlock legislation and take steps to improve the current ignition interlock law. It's time to join at least half of the United States who have these laws, as states like West Virginia and Arizona, where drunk driving fatalities have dropped by 40 to 50% since passing ignition interlocks. With clear evidence that these devices stop drunk drivers, we must ask our legislators, you guys. We aren't offered the same protection offered by all offender interlocks enjoyed by road users in 25 other states. You have the opportunity to change this with HF1112. I want to personally thank Representative Norton for her leadership in improving Minnesota's ignition interlock law. MAD Minnesota sincerely hopes that all lawmakers will recognize the life-saving benefits these changes will provide and will support this legislation to improve Minnesota's ignition interlock. Thank you again for the invitation.
Thank you for your testimony. I'm sorry, we didn't get your name.
Gina Calistro.
Gina.
And I have one more thing I want to mention. There were some great questions about ignition interlock devices and the different vendors. We are having a informational tomorrow where Representative Norton, Representative Kelly will be, and Senator Eaton will be there between 1 o'clock tomorrow, March 24th, room 181. And what we want to do is give an opportunity for information to touch the devices. There'll be vendors there with the devices. If you have additional questions, I think it'd be a great opportunity to come and find out for yourself what these devices are all about.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify? All right. Any other questions from members? Representative Norton, two-year bill.
Well, members, again, I'm not going to repeat what I've said. I just think it is time. Other states have moved in this direction. They're having wonderful results. We have far too many DUI recidivism arrests in this state. We have far too many lives that have been taken, and we can take action today to at least take the first step in moving toward ignition interlock for all offenders. And so I would very much appreciate your support in moving this bill to its next committee. And I want to thank Representative Kelly for giving us this hearing today. It's very important to my constituent and obviously to many people across the state. And I'm very appreciative.
Thank you, Representative Norton. Just one point, members. We did request has been made by DPS for a fiscal note about a week ago. We're a little disappointed we didn't have that yet, but we'll be pushing on them to do that for the next step. And Representative Norton removes her motion that House File 1112, as amended, be passed and referred to public safety. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Erdahl. Okay. Welcome, Representative Erdahl, to your committee. I will move House File 3104, and that will be to the General Register on the floor. Representative Erdahl, to your bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This bill designates the segment of marked Trunk Highway 7 in McLeod County as Patrol Officer Michael Allen Hogan Memorial Highway. Officer Hogan was killed in Hutchinson in the line of duty, and I do have a couple of testifiers to give a little detail as to why this bill would be important to our area.
My name is David Berlinson. I'm a retired Hutchinson police lieutenant, and thank you for your time today. I realize your time is short, so I won't go into the what generally is kind of a painful story for me to share as to how Mike died. I think you've heard enough pain with the previous speakers. Highway 7 was significant in, unfortunately, in Officer Hogan's death. Four individuals came out of Minneapolis on Highway 7 on a Christmas shoplifting spree in 1989 on a Friday night, December 15th, extremely cold night. And Mike was called to a shoplifting report. Mike and I were partners for 10 years. And that particular night, Mike dropped me off at home on his way to his last call. There was no indication that there was anything amiss with the call. It was, you know, what we considered a routine kind of a call. We shared good night, and off Mike went on his last call. I can still see the police car and hear it going down Merrill Street as he hustled to his last call, because he always hustled. Ironically, Mike drove by, he lived on Merrill Street, he drove by his own home with most of his family at home that night. He didn't stop to say hello, he didn't stop to say goodbye, because he was doing his duty. And directly across the street from his home, ironically, was his church, in which 4 days later his funeral would be held. Mike went, it was to at a JCPenney store in a mall. Mike was actually trying to verify this, I almost said gentleman, this suspect's story. And when, unbeknownst to Mike, this was a wanted person. He had a parole violation. If he was captured, he would be sent back to prison. And he knew it. And he was armed. And Mike was actually on the telephone with the store manager when the person figured out that his story wasn't washing. And at that point, he stood up, pulled out his revolver, shot Mike in the head from a distance about 3 feet, 4 feet. Killed him instantly, turned the revolver on the store manager. She fell to her knees, covered her head, told us that she thought she was going to be killed. He, for whatever reason, decided not to kill her. He ran out of the store. His accomplices, there were two females and another male with them on this shoplifting spree. They had moved their car because it had taken them so long inside the store, and they were kind of looking for him. When he couldn't find the car, he kidnapped a Hutchinson couple from a local McDonald's drive-thru. They left Hutchinson on Highway 7, went back into Minneapolis, where they dropped him off at the location that he asked, and then they found the police, and then the search was on. We captured the three accomplices on a roadblock on Highway 7. The Minneapolis police hounded relentlessly, hunted for this person, and over the weekend, ultimately, he kidnapped another young lady during the weekend, sexually assaulted her, made her drive him around, and he was looking for money and trying to stop at acquaintances, but the police were hot on his trail. Ultimately, on Monday night, the night of Mike's reveal, the police on a broken tail light stop or attempted a stop found this car and we still say Mike chased this guy back to us because they got on Highway 7 and the police were trying to stop him, or this officer was trying to stop him, and a pursuit ensued. And it came all the way back to McLeod County, just over the line, and went into the ditch, and he, right by farmhouse, and he got into the farmhouse because he had this female hostage with him. And now he had a whole family that he had as hostages, Highway 7, County Road 9. During the night, 150 police officers of all different uniforms and stripes showed up. 4 o'clock in the morning, which this is something I never thought would happen, he surrendered. And ironically, Mike's funeral that was the next day, or actually that day, on Tuesday, and Mike is buried in Fort Snelling because he's a military veteran, Vietnam. And the hearse that carried Mike's body to Fort Snelling drove him in on Highway 7 right past the farmhouse where his killer was captured less than 10, 12 hours earlier. So that is why we're asking for Highway 7, at least from Hutchinson East to the Carver County line. But if I could quickly share one story about Highway 7 to the west that Mike was involved in. 1982, 1983, I forget the year, we received a mutual aid request from McLeod County Sheriff's Office on a serious accident. There were no deputies or troopers around close enough to handle that call. And Mike and his partner went out there about 4 miles west on Highway 7, and they found a partially submerged car in a very deep water-filled ditch. And Mike and his partner went into the ditch immediately, up to their chest in this icy cold water, and held this car up to keep it from becoming completely submerged. Unfortunately, there was a fatality related with that accident, but there were also people that were saved. And these folks weren't Hutchinson residents, they weren't McLeod County residents, but they were Minnesota residents, and they were traveling on Minnesota Highway number 7, and they needed police help. And Mike went to their aid without hesitation. And that's why we're asking for the entire length of Highway 7 through McLeod County. We feel that would be appropriate. And thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Chief Dan Hatton with the Hutchinson Police Department. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity. I'd just like to add just two more things in regards to Officer Hogan himself. All these years later, Mike still has a significant impact in regards to the community. He was a Hutchinson boy, grew up there, was a military guy, went to the military. When he got out of the military, he chose to come back to his hometown to work. protect the people that helped him grow up. He's a family man. He had three children, very young children at the time of his death. Obviously, he never got to witness all of that, all the things that his children have since then accomplished. So he is more than just a police officer in the city of Hutchinson. His impact on that community and his loss to that community is still measured and seen today. Mike was killed on December 15th. Even all these years later, December 15th, the PD receives cards from the community. We received different kinds of trays of cookies and everything else, just in acknowledgement of the department's loss. So I just bring that up in regards to that. Even though we're asking for this, even all these years later, that's still the impact that Mike and this incident have had on our community. So even though it's been some 27 years later, it still has a significant impact. You walk into our lobby, you see Mike's photo. Every one of our patrol officers every day push a black and white through town, and there's a badge number. Mike's badge number, it's been retired, sits on those fenders. You know, we kind of refer to that as Mike's still riding with us. He's trying to protect us. So it may seem a little odd that it's this many years later that we're asking for that request, but it still has a significant impact on a community the size of Hutchinson. So again, thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Chief Haddon. Representative Erdo, sir, we didn't get your name for the committee record.
I'm sorry. David Erwinson.
Thank you. Representative Erdo.
Well, just thank you for allowing the hearing. I appreciate your support on this piece of legislation. I think the memory of Officer Hogan needs to be further extended and by designating Highway 7 through McLeod County, I think would be a very fit memorial to the life and death of Officer Hogan.
Thank you. Are there any questions from members? Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify in regards to this bill? I do thank you for your testimony, and I will renew my motion. That House File 3104 be passed sent to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. That motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Petersburg.
Hold on, John.
Hold on a second. Green. I guess Robson. Representative Green. Okay, Representative Green, I will move House File 1495, and that would be referred to Ways and Means. So, Representative Green, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. House File 1495 is a bill that I've had for a little while, and it tells you what it's for. It's for training for the Minnesota Highway Patrol, and I have testifiers, and I'd like to just turn it over to them if that's all right.
That is fine. Welcome, Colonel Langer, if you could state your name.
Mr. Chair, members of the...
Hold on, just one moment. I think we have an amendment, Representative Green. Okay, members, we have a B-16 amendment to the bill. I think it would be in your packets. It reduces the... Revisor's amendment reduces the amount 6.5 and inserts 4.5 million and deletes 2016 and inserts 2017. So I will move that A16 amendment to get it in the way the author wanted that. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Amendment prevails. Colonel Langer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Matt Langer, Chief of the State Patrol. And as Representative Green says, the language here is pretty straightforward. It allows for us to have an additional academy or an additional academies in the future, which allows us to do a better job of recruiting, a better job of planning, and a better job of working toward our mission, which sadly has been escaping us for 2015 and so far in 2016. So bottom line is this funding would be applied directly toward future State Patrol academies to get troopers out on the road doing what we are paid to do, and that is to prevent traffic fatalities and crashes in Minnesota.
Questions from members? Representative Norton.
Yes, thank you. And again, back to Twitter, but you guys do a nice job, too, of tweeting. And one of the things that I noticed this last year was a lot of recruitment effort being made. Is it difficult to find people right now to go into the field, or do you have any understanding of why it's so hard to recruit people to go into it, or am I misunderstanding those tweets?
Chief Langer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Norton, it makes me happy that you're seeing those tweets because that's exactly what they're intended to do. We've always...
I'm old.
You're never too old. We've always worked very hard to recruit and hire just the best and brightest people that we can find. And we've moved a lot of our recruitment effort to social media, and we've been highly successful. In fact, this last year we did some just informal speaking on some radio stations, and lo and behold, some of the troopers that are in the academy right now found out about our hiring simply because they heard it on the radio. So we've done a really, it's all with intent to get the word out as much as we can to some of those non-traditional to some of us, but traditional to the populations that we're trying to reach.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment we just added, was this initially, was it brought by you, and was it some sort of like an emergency appropriation that you were hoping to get to immediately for some reason, or because now it's been delayed a year? What are the implications of the amendment we added?
Representative Green.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, this came up actually, I think, to the end of 2013 when the Trooper Academy was not funded, and there was no money in the transportation bill. The Trunk Highway Funds is what pays for it. And the governor's recommendations then had came in, and so then I carried a bill. Oh, actually, that's not true. Representative Lohmer carried a bill in the House, and Senator Fischbach in the Senate to put that funding forward. Otherwise, they would have not had their academy that year. And so we picked up on it the next year, hoping to have funding into the future so that they wouldn't be put in the position, because as I understand it, you don't just open the doors and have an academy. It takes a while to recruit people to come in. So if they can't plan ahead, it's very difficult for them. And the reason for the lower amount is this is also now in the governor's recommendations. And these are some of the numbers that he came forward. And so what you see with the lower amount reflects a portion of what the governor was recommending.
Representative Rumbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And perhaps the trooper can answer this. So you have $4.5 million, and it says it's for additional troopers. What is your average cost then to recruit, hire, train, and equip a new trooper?
Chief Langer.
Representative, it's a great question. Currently, right now, today, we have 545 state troopers and an additional 58 that are going through the academy right now. So that gives you a little bit of context. The actual academy costs are tough sometimes. It depends how many people are in the academy. But traditionally, it's about $2.5 million to hold the academy, including the costs at Camp Ripley, the meals, the lodging, the salaries for the cadets that are paid by statute at 70% of the base trooper wage. And then the additional money is for equipment. A lot of the equipment we can reuse, and we gladly do to make good use of previously purchased equipment. But there are certain things that just can't be reused and have to be replaced. So the remaining money there in that $4.5 million it would be used to buy the equipment that can't be reused.
Well, Mr. Chair and sir, there. Then, so the $4.5 million will bring you a new class of troopers, and how many will that be?
Chief Langer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rumbag, it's another great question. It's tough to answer that because what we would do, the intent of this language from our perspective and what we've been articulating is it allows us to carry the overhead cost of the academy, but the actual number of troopers in the academy would be dependent on our entire trunk highway appropriation and hiring as many troopers as we can within that appropriation, depending on retirements, resignations, and attrition. So I can't accurately say exactly how many troopers we would hire in 2017, 18, or 19, other than to tell you that the $4.5 million relieves a lot of pressure for us on our actual appropriation, guarantees us the ability to have in the academy, and guarantees us the ability to fill that academy as much as possible with the vacancies that we would have at the time.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up then, are you constantly retraining your troopers? I mean, are they, you know, annually, like a lot of professionals go through recertification and, you know, updating. Does that going on an annual basis within the
Chief
group?
Chief Langer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rumbeck, absolutely. They train twice a year, once centralized at Camp Ripley and once in their district. And then, but we have an academy. New employees coming in to be troopers are required to go through the academy before they're on the road. And so we desperately try to do one of those each year, and if we don't, we get behind real quickly, and then we end up playing catch-up. And it's really, in my opinion, a very ineffective way to staff for state troopers and hinders our ability to do the best job we can.
So, Mr. Chair,
Representative,
once again then, so normally this would be in your ongoing budget, is that correct? But because we didn't do it last year, then that's why this would not occur normally. Is this right?
Chief Langer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rumbeck, I think we're on the same page. The intent here is to provide a mechanism to ensure that we will have money to host that academy versus hope we have money to host that academy.
Thank you.
Any other questions for members? Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 1495, as amended, be passed and referred to. Where is this?
This is going
to Ways
and Means.
Ways and Means.
Yeah, Ways and Means.
Thank you. Thank you. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Langer. Representative Anderson.
Ways and Means.
Yep. And everyone's excited for your first bill here in our committee, Representative Anderson.
Round two.
Do we have any amendments?
No.
No.
Okay.
No, I don't think we should. Let's give him a break.
It's not in the...
No. I know my mayor wants to.
I was keeping your chair on.
Okay.
We're going to eat his cookies and be done with it.
Yeah. Representative Anderson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My motion here is to re-refer this House File 3175 to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices.
All right, Representative Anderson.
So the House File 3175, it's a Department of Public Safety agency request. I'll say a few things and then I'll turn it over to the department here. The purpose of this bill is to come into compliance with FBI requirements for criminal background checks procedures. It streamlines the process for driver and vehicle services to receive background check results directly from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension for those applying to be instructors at driving schools. Under the current procedure, applicants to be a driving instructor must consent to clear a background check, but DVS has to get the results from the instructor. And this bill will allow DVS to get results from the BCA so they can quickly process the applications. Just a little note, the current background check fees will cover the procedure change. So the fiscal note returned at a zero net cost. I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Engler of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension.
All right. Welcome, Ms. Engler. Could you please state your name for the record?
Brightline, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Katie Engler with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. My purpose for being here today is to explain a little bit about how the background check process works. Specifically, the Driver and Vehicle Services Division wants to have a federal criminal history background check on people who want to be licensed as driving instructors. And in order to do that, the state has to comply with something called Public Law 92-544. It's a federal law that sets up the process for parties to have access to the federal criminal history. And the statute has to have certain requirements met in order to be approved by the U.S. Attorney General. First of all, it has to require that the person submit their fingerprints. It has to expressly authorize the use of the FBI records for this purpose. It needs to identify the category of transaction. In this case, it's a license to be a driving instructor for which the records are going to be used, and the statute has to be not against public policy. Once you enact the legislation, it will then be submitted to the FBI, who acts as the delegate for the U.S. Attorney General, and background checks at the federal level would not occur until approval is received. The BCA's role in all of this is we're what's called the State Identification Bureau for the state of Minnesota. These types of transactions for background checks are done through the Bureau, as we are the conduit to get to the FBI for access to the records, which come back to us and then would be provided to Driver and Vehicle Services in order to make a decision whether or not an individual is disqualified from being licensed. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Members? We have any more testifiers? Oh, Representative Duskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Engler, why is the agency, and I always struggle with agency bills because I don't trust the government very much. But Ms. Engler, why are we wanting to take people's fingerprints in order to be a driver's license instructor? I mean, we did this reluctantly with some of the licensing for physical therapists and other things last session or the session before, and I don't know. Can you answer why do we have to require, in order for them to be a driver's license instructor, to teach somebody how to drive a car, they have to give up their fingerprints?
Singler?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that question really ought to be answered by Driver and Vehicle Services, because they're the ones issuing the license.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Please state your name for the committee record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Don Hicks. I'm the Driver Education Coordinator with DPS, Driver and Vehicle Services. Representative, one of the reasons that we want to do both the BCA background check and the FBI background check is most of the commercial driver training schools in Minnesota provide their training one-on-one, one student, one instructor in a vehicle. We want to do the best job to ensure that we're not putting potential female students in with a male instructor that may have some type of criminal background that we're not aware of. That's why we do the BCA check in Minnesota and the FBI check nationwide, to rule out any potential criminal activity.
President Duskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm kind of confused. I mean, if it's a criminal, if it's a male instructor or female instructor, I don't think it matters. But what I'm wondering is why are we requiring to give up fingerprints in order to be an instructor? That's what's required for the FBI stuff? Is that what you're saying to us? You have to have the fingerprints in order to get in the FBI database? Is that the deal?
Mr. Hex.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. It's my understanding that the only way the BCA or the FBI can conduct the background check is with the fingerprints.
And what do we do currently?
Mr. Hex.
Mr. Chair, Representative, currently the process is that when we receive an application for a commercial driver training instructor, the instructor himself or herself submits their fingerprint card directly to the FBI, and the FBI sends the results back to the instructor candidate, and the instructor candidate sends the results, the single sheet or however many sheets of paper it is, to Driver and Vehicle Services Office of Driver Education.
Representative Scalzo.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm not following the bill very well, but it sounds like, so what I heard is we're already requiring them to give up their fingerprints, but instead the department is now going to have them, so state government will have them too. Is that the difference here?
Mr. Heck?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we've been requiring the FBI fingerprints for all commercial driver training instructors since we did major rule revisions in 2004.
Representative Duskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe we can talk offline more about this, but again, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience who'd like to testify on this bill or in opposition? Representative Anderson, you'll have the final say.
Thank you for the opportunity, and I hope you enjoy the cookies.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Renews his motion that House File 3175 be passed and referred to civil law. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
Motion prevails. Representative Petersburg.
Nash really wanted to grill you, but I told him he couldn't.
Members, we do have.
Who's coming in?
Commerce Committee does come in right after us, so we will need to be on time with this. So, with that, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you like me to move this bill?
Please.
I believe I'd like to move House File 2014 to be referred upon passage to or approval to civil law. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And I do have one amendment as well, which is House H2014A1, which is kind of a reworking of it, and it's in the language that the Senate has already passed as well. And so I would move that approval as well.
Representative Petersburg moved the A1 amendment. Any questions to the amendment? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no.
And Mr. Chair, as I mentioned before, there is a slight, I'd like to do a verbal amendment to this amendment. It was just an oversight, an omission. After, on line 1.6, after the number 3, it should be added by the Commissioner of Transportation. And that was in the original bill as well, and that was just left off. Without that clarification, this could apply to all road authority, and this bill was really intended just for the Department of Transportation. So I'd like that verbal amendment if possible.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Let me see if we... process-wise, if we went a little too far, too quick here. Okay. All right. So Representative Petersburg wants to verbally amend the amendment then. Can you state that again then, Representative
yes.
Petersburg?
Yes. Line 1.6. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
You want me to? Line 1.6. After the number 3, just add the 5 words by the Commissioner of Transportation.
Representative Hausman, did you have a question on this oral amendment?
Not for the oral amendment.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
All right. So Representative Petersburg moves the oral amendment on line 1.6 after the number 3, add by the Commissioner of Transportation. Questions on that? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. An amendment to the amendment prevails. Okay. Representative Petersburg, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Thank you for hearing this bill. This is one in which there had been somewhat of an oversight over the years about some due process in regards to, businesses and others that may be requesting access to roads through driveways and others, that the Department of Transportation, underneath its purview and responsibility, has a decision on whether or not they allow the bill or the driveway there or in another location. And this bill doesn't intend to take away any of that responsibility or authority. They still need to do that. They need to provide all of that. But prior to this, there was really no appeals process. There was no availability of requesting some options for them. And from talking with the department at one time, the ombudsman program was kind of designed to do that, but it didn't really work very well. And I do want to comment on the department. Since this bill was introduced last year after deadlines, we were able to, they were willing and have done a lot of work in putting some internal processes together for some appeal process, and they'll be talking about that later as well. But what we're really looking for is that we're looking for a neutral party when appeal process goes through and a determination is made that may be adverse to a business or to an individual, if it might happen on a rural setting situation, that there is a feeling, at least by the public, that there is a fair and equitable determination on the outcome of the decision. So again, we're not trying to take away the department's authority, but we do think there is a due process issue that should be dealt with. And this bill simply addresses that there will be a neutral party, would be one of the remedies that a person could use to explore. They may choose not to do so, but this does give them an option. And with that, I do have a testifier or two, I believe, and you do have a letter in front of you, but I will turn it over to Mr. Coyle.
Mr. Coyle, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Transportation Committee and staff, my name is Peter Coyle. I'm a lobbyist with Larkin Hoffman. My client for today's hearing is Casey's General Stores, which is a regional convenience store chain based out of Iowa, but with approximately 120 store locations in southern and western Minnesota and roughly in the central Minnesota area as well. I'm testifying on behalf of Casey's, but I'm also testifying on behalf of a business coalition, the members of which are identified in a letter that's in your packet. As Representative Petersburg indicated, there's frankly a gap in the statute that deals with how access to state right-of-way can be challenged by a property owner who feels aggrieved. And the circumstance that arises, very simply, throughout Minnesota is you have an existing business that wants to redevelop their property, or you have a new business that wants to move into a community that wants to establish a new business or perhaps some other nonprofit or civic operation, privately owned, of course. And the Department of Transportation really holds the key as to whether or not they have any ability to access directly the state highway that may run through their adjacent to their property. For virtually all small to medium-sized communities throughout Minnesota, and including larger cities, the state highway is the backbone to their commercial center. It's Main Street. And so if a business owner is not able to access the state highway for their business, the probabilities of them being able to have a successful business venture are substantially diminished. In fact, I routinely counsel clients who come to me and say, if I can't access the state highway, I can't do this project because I will not be able to be successful. As it turns out, while there are often opportunities to talk with the engineers that are responsible for the state in managing this right of way, and I have great respect for the work that they fulfill on behalf of the state, there is not a way in which a property owner can challenge a denial in a means that gives them a third-party review. This bill would establish that third-party review. It allows the property owner to make a claim in district court. It establishes for the first time in statute a standard by which the commissioner's decision, really his staff, would be determined as being fair and equitable. And certainly it doesn't preclude the opportunity for continued conversation between the property owner and the engineering department in hopes of reaching a satisfactory resolution. But too often what happens is the state has a policy, your application doesn't meet our policy, and the property owner is basically left with no remedy. So long story short, this bill proposes to create that remedy. It doesn't generate any new obligations on behalf of the department that they're not already doing today, but it simply provides the property owner with a means of some redress if they feel like they are really deprived of the opportunity to pursue a use of their property that they think is legitimate. That's my testimony, Mr. Chairman and members. I don't believe there's any other testifiers, at least on my side of the equation, for the bill, but I'm happy to respond to questions if you have any.
Thank you. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Presumably, public safety would usually be the reason MnDOT would make the determination of access to, you know, what's the access onto a highway. I don't know, maybe MnDOT is the better person. I don't know how many of these we have and how often this occurs. What occurs to me is we have to build in some cost for the department to defend itself in court or something like that.
Representative Hausman, we do have a fiscal note from the department that does include that, and we do have someone from the department that will be testifying. Okay. If you'd like to ask them that question.
They might be in the better
position. Mr. Chair, if I could, I would like to respond. The public safety question certainly is important, Representative Hausman, and that's often part of the debate. But as often as not, public safety is really not the issue. It's an engineering geometrics design question. And even when you come in with evidence that shows there's a lack of accident history, or that the traffic volumes that are going past the location are within the norms of what's allowed, sometimes it's just we got a policy and this doesn't satisfy the policy. So you don't even really get to the safety issue. You don't even really get to the design issue because it runs afoul of the policy. And so there just needs to be a way to provide redress. And again, I appreciate that the department may see that differently, but that's the way I see it and observe it when I speak with my clients.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Coyle, thank you for your clarifications. How long is this appeal process that you envision to take? I mean, I imagine it's different on a case-by-case basis, but typically what are you talking about, you know, if there's an action that you're concerned about that MnDOT has taken, presumably you're filing something with an
right.
ALJ. How long does this typically take from start to finish?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, best guesstimate, 6 months. And the process that would be that you file a complaint in district court, you allege that the department didn't have a proper basis to deny the permit. It could be a summary judgment motion because the engineering record will be there. Property owner will have their engineer. The department will have its engineering policies. And the judge will make the factual determination as to whether the department has met its burden. That's it.
Representative Hornstein.
So then, thank you. And then, so what happens in this intervening 6 months? Is there access? Is there not access? Does it affect the construction in any way? Is that consideration?
Mr. Chair, well, Representative, the project doesn't go forward. You have no access until you get a permit approved by the department. And even that lapse of time could be sufficient to kill the project. So the remedy by itself may kill the project as well, just because of the passage of time.
That's the concern. Thank you.
And Mr. Coyle, those projects are generally for the business owner for that access, correct?
Correct. Right. And very often it's a community development initiative as well. So you see city administrators or community development folks who just really don't have a way to move this forward, even though they're trying to do something constructive for their community, a new grocery store, a new pharmacy, some other type of retail development that may be successful along the main drag, if you will. And it makes it very difficult for communities to reinvent themselves to try to attract new dollars to their community or to help an existing business reinvest.
Thank you. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this might be more of a question for staff. I'm reading the House research where it says the appeals process does not apply to permit denials by other road authorities. Just for my information, maybe, what is the appeals process if the county or another road authority, a landowner or developer has a dispute, and are they just out of luck?
Mr. Burris?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kosnick, I'm not quite sure what the appeals process is under that. I would have to dig into it a bit further to be able to give you a good answer on that.
Mr. Coyle?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's likewise non-existent.
Yeah. Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Mr. Coyle's point, and I'm thinking Representative Nash, as a former mayor, probably ran into this before too. But it's a common problem for a lot of cities in your zoning plans and everything else, and to attract businesses along Main Street or other state highways, because if MnDOT doesn't grant you these entrances, the project normally doesn't go. And there has not been an appeal process, and even if it does take 6 months or whatever, I think it would be a good thing. Sometimes it's public safety, sometimes it's engineering, other times, you know, peak traffic volumes and things like that. But it's not thoroughly vetted. A lot of times it just happens. The answer is no. No driveway, no access, and the business community and the cities have no redress.
Mr. Chair, it may be appropriate to have Mr. Cage come up from the department and testify as well.
I agree, Representative Petersburg. Hello, welcome to the committee, and please state your name for our records.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Brian Gage. I'm MnDOT's manager, or MnDOT's capital, I have multiple titles at the moment. I'm MnDOT State Access Management Engineer. I've been in that position since 2000. So I just
Mr.
want
Gage.
To
address. Go ahead. Yes.
Okay. MnDOT's access management policy is really an iterative process where MnDOT staff works with the applicant and with the local government to provide reasonably convenient and suitable access for the adjacent property owners while preventing interference with the safety of the highway system.
Yeah.
This is consistent with Minnesota Statute 160-18. This applies to both new driveways and for change of use. And in some cases, the recommendation may be that the best access or the most appropriate access to address both safety and reasonableness is off the local system, and it's not directly onto the MnDOT highway. When it comes to denials, typically there's two types of denials. One is where the state of Minnesota has previously bought the access rights to the system, much like we buy right-of-way and everything else. We had paid a property owner for that right of access, and they no longer have that right of access. The second one is pretty much exclusively an impasse between the conditions MnDOT is putting on the permit for the safe use of the highway and the applicant's view of what is reasonable for their desired use. Since 2013, MnDOT has approved nearly 1,000 access permits and only denying 20, which is about 2% of that. MnDOT's permitting process was updated in the early 2000s based on the findings of the report to the 1999 Minnesota legislature, entitled Minnesota's Access Management Policy. The report identified that access management was a key feature for the strategy to preserve and maintain the safety, capacity, and mobility of the state's highway system and links the communities and businesses it serves. It also noted that additional legislative action was not needed at that time for Minnesota to accomplish this, or MnDOT to accomplish this. So following that, MnDOT updated the permitting process to include including an oversight committee that helped us put the permitting process together. It included MnDOT, districts, our specialty offices, representation from cities, states, MPOs, and it also included specific guidance and engineering guidance so we could have consistency across the state as our permitting technicians were doing the permitting process. The consideration for a detailed appeals process took place at the same time MnDOT was instituting the Ombudsman's office. And at that time, it was decided the Ombudsman's office would be the focal point when impasse was reached between MnDOT and permit applicant. These processes and the engineering guidance are noted in MnDOT's Access Management Manual, which is online. Both the engineering guidance and the procedures of MnDOT's Access Management Manual are updated periodically. We are just going through now, here's the National Access Management Guidance, which has engineering guidance, some permitting guidance, policy guidance, land use guidance. So we're working through that as we look at what we did back in 2006, 2008 to see if there are updates needed. Last fall, our Council General identified changes that were needed in the permitting process to more clearly align with Minnesota Statute 1599, time deadline for agency action. At this time, we also, the purpose or the role of our ombudsman office also was changing. So we realized it was time to revisit the appeals process. So MnDOT has recently completed this revision. It is posted on our access management webpage and in our manual. And we are in the process of going out and educating our districts and our internal staff and specialty offices of these new revisions. The new permitting process does identify timelines, clear procedural and communication steps that is necessary by the district when communicating with applicants, letting them know that there is an appeals process available, what the timeline is for that, and then it also identifies the roles and responsibilities of the district engineer and others in this process. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gage, what were the numbers that you said? How many permits you had granted and over what time period?
Chairman, we had, since 2013, about 1,000, just shy of 1,000 permits were approved, and of that, denials were 20 of them.
Okay, thank
2%.
You. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of those 20 denied, is there a common reason? Is there one that's the most usual?
Mr. Gage.
When they say the only denial.
Chair, member, I'm not sure of the specifics on that. I can look that up and find that out. And typically, like I said, it is either that we have already purchased access rights, so the right is not there for access, or it's a disagreement in where the driveway would be located.
And Mr. Chair and the gentleman at the table, if I've forgotten your name, I'm looking for the fiscal note. Do you know, and maybe you can't answer this, whoever determined that fiscal note, did they assume there would be some legal fees then that the department would be responsible for? Attorney's fees or?
Mr. Gage.
Representative Hausman, Chair. There were fees identified in there from our Counsel General Office.
And Mr. Chair, if members don't know about this, by the way, we have a staff member who helps us sometimes resolve problems, and she routinely advises us to use this ombudsman, and she declares this person extremely helpful. So if you haven't ever used this person, I mean, I think it's important. I appreciated your mentioning that, because all I can say is, those who have used that process have found that office or person doing exactly what they're supposed to do, which is resolving the issues.
Yes, Representative Hausman, in fact, they not only used the department's legal people, there was also fees for administrative law judge and the state attorney general's office. So there were a number of legal fees put into that fiscal note, which I think I have some questions with. But Mr. Burrs, did you have, or Andy, did you have comments on that fiscal note?
Mr. Chair and members, just to clarify, the fiscal note was drafted against the original language and doesn't reflect the DE amendment that was just added. In speaking with MnDOT this morning, they believe that the DE would increase costs slightly if it, these cases were automatically to go to district court. They couldn't say exactly how much. I would imagine the order of magnitude would be in the hundreds of thousands. And to clarify where that comes out of, it's all from the Trunk Highway Fund. It would be part of projects or part of various appropriations that we make to MnDOT. So it wouldn't be an additional appropriation to MnDOT. It would just be more funds used up for legal fees.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a question about the wording on line 1.9. It says, with the this is the criteria, with construction, maintenance, and safe use of the highway. Mr. Burrs, does that mean that all three would have to apply? So if it's only a safety issue but doesn't affect the construction or maintenance, would the state have to, they wouldn't be able to prove their case?
Mr. Burrs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, that would be my initial take. Court, in looking at this language, might not take "and" to be inclusive, but initially I would tend to agree with you on that. One thing I might note is that that language is essentially reproduced from what current law is regarding the requirements around local units of government and the Commissioner of Transportation to provide permits in the first place. This is essentially a reproduction of that test of when that kind of analysis that the unit of government or the commissioner is supposed to use in evaluating granting or denials of permits.
Representative Nash.
My question was answered.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you. Just very quickly, Mr. Chair, because I know we're needing to move on here, but what are some of the typical safety concerns that you have in these situations?
Mr. Gage.
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein. Typically, we do have guidance in ours that we look at the distance of the intersection from, or the distance of the new driveway from the intersection. There's a driver expectancy of if you're following someone, are they turning in the driveway or in the next street? Their sight distance is always an issue there. There's depending looking at the volume of traffic on the road, such as that. Let's see, as well as that, there's the spacing of the driveways between themselves. If you start putting driveways too close together, you're blocking the view, again, affecting the sight lines of that. We also look at potentially the, you know, what type of driveway design it needs, whether you need a area to slow down or reduce before going into it, coming off a high-speed system such as a turn lane or an acceleration lane, or are you having the traffic slow down within the turn lane to make that turn?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Gage, those requirements would be pretty well spelled out, wouldn't they, if a business owner looked at that and said, "These, I understand what the requirements are going to be," so that they would know that up front before going into their project, most likely, wouldn't they?
Mr. Chair, yes, they would. We do have them. Like I said, they are in both our permitting guidance chapter on our line, and we also have our Chapter 3, which is the overall guidance. That really spells out MnDOT's approach to information that's in the national guidance, and then also based on research that the Minnesota DOT has done over time on turn lanes, sight distance, items like that.
All right. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Are there any other questions from members? Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, this bill is not to overrule the department's decisions in all cases. It's just another situation where, and I have to comment and compliment the department on streamlining and actually putting in detail the process that they go through for their own appeals. Mm-hmm. The bottom line, though, is that appeal process stops, according to their rules and regulations, with the district engineer who will have final say. And when we're dealing with the public, it's always nice if there's an appeals process in which a neutral third party has an opportunity to review. And that's all we're asking for here, is that this be given the same appeals process by a third neutral party as most any other agencies or decisions. So I thank you for that, and I renew my motion for it to move.
Thank you. Representative Petersburg renews his motion, House File 2014, to be referred to civil law. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails. Members, our next meeting will be Tuesday at 5 o'clock or 15 minutes after session. Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.